Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room is Michael Frome, and the topic of his talk is celebrating the Wilderness Act. So let's listen in on Michael Frome.
We're talking about the benefits of computers. And hi there, Jim.
Hi, Michael.
I think we'll wait another couple of minutes if that's okay.
On the other hand, there's a statistic that I saw that says by the end of the century, there'll be 150 million personal computers in the landfill.
In the landfill?
In this country.
Well, I don't know the answer to that. That's not good. Thinking I was throwing away. I had a, you know what a dustbuster is?
Mm-hmm.
And I had a dustbuster, and I took it down to the fix-it shop, and it turned out it would cost as much to repair it as to buy a new one. Well, what do I do with the old one?
Same and VCRs.
What?
VCRs are the same way.
It doesn't make sense.
Well, these 150 million, probably half of them will still be working. But, you know, they'll be obsolete.
Can we use the parts?
No, because the parts are obsolete.
The parts are obsolete.
There's lots of people in third world countries that maybe would like to have that computer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they can put them in their landfills. I thought if we wait another minute, is that okay? Let's see. How it's going. We weren't going to start. What time? What's the official time?
Official time is 11:50.
Okay, let's wait till 11:51 and a half. That's okay. You know, somehow I had hoped to conduct these classes out of doors. But it doesn't seem to be the mode, and people do spend plenty of time out of doors anyway, so you're told to keep it down to prescribed hour, I guess, so that's not too bad to be indoors, I guess. But I teach at Western Washington University, and the students get so restless indoors in good weather, and I don't blame them.
Do you hold any outdoor classes?
I try to, but it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. On a day like this, we go outdoors on the campus, but then some of them pay attention and some don't. And it's best to schedule field trips, but then they've got conflicts with jobs and other classes. So it's really been tough to hold classes outdoors. And then they complain about it, and they're absolutely wrong. And I complain about it. Anyway, so we can officially begin. And I'm happy to see so many wilderness enthusiasts or people who are interested in wilderness here to help celebrate this year the 30th anniversary of the Wilderness Act of 1964. And what I say on the occasion of the 30th anniversary of the Wilderness Act is, congratulations, America. I love wilderness in a personal way. It enriches my body. It elevates my mind and spirit to look and be above and beyond my own wants and needs. Wilderness makes me a better person. Likewise, I honor the Wilderness Act and all that it stands for. I think of it as an expression, through written law, of national ethics and idealism. It is a symbol of hope that lights the path to an age of reason and nonviolence, an age of respect for the earth and as a source of respect for one another. True, I'm reading, but I'm reading my own lines. Wilderness is America. Wilderness is America. Wilderness is the heartland of the bald eagle, the condor, and the spotted owl. Birds that nest in the tops of old trees or in rotted holes in tree trunks and that need dead and dying logs to house the grubs and other insects on which they feed. Wilderness is grizzly bears and mountain lions and bighorn sheep and elk and wolves. Wilderness is rivers, accorded their right to exist because they are rivers, rather than being subjugated for any utilitarian purposes. I honor the river as a living symbol of all the life it sustains in wild America, the original America as God made it. Now, in the past couple of lectures, I gave a little introduction to history of wilderness policy and principle in our country. So today I want to give a little bit more and show some personalities and issues and incidents that led to the passage of the Wilderness Act in 1964 and that bring us up to our time. And some of, who's all from Wisconsin? So you know the name of Alder Leopold, and we will deal with Alder Leopold in a minute. I could go back to the establishment of the National Forest and the National Forest Reserves in 1897, but I won't go there. I'll start after World War I and mention the name of Arthur Carhart. Somebody here from Minnesota? Who's been in the Boundary Waters Wilderness? So I'm going to talk a little, mention briefly the Boundary Waters Wilderness and how it came to be. Bearing in mind that when God made the world, it was all a wilderness. We didn't have to say this is wilderness or this is a national park. Well, this is the Boundary Waters Wilderness. It was all Earth National Park. That's the way God made the earth. And then we snipped away at it here and there until finally some idealistic people decided we have to save a little bit of it the way God made it. And Arthur Carhart came to work for the Forest Service after World War I. He was the first landscape engineer employed by the Forest Service. They sent him down to an area in Colorado, Trappers Lake in the White River National Forest, and they said, design a recreational layout for homes in the forest. And it came to him that that was the wrong thing to do, that the right thing to do was to not have any roads or development in there. And his was one of the earliest visions in our era of preserving wilderness. And then they sent it to the up to the Superior National Forest in Minnesota with the same idea. They told him to lay out roads, lay out recreation homes, as part of the development of the National Forest, service to the people. Instead, he wrote a report declaring, the first logical step in any work of this type is to plan for preservation and protection of all those things that are of values great enough to sacrifice a certain amount of economic return so there may be a greater total return from the aesthetic qualities. And this was really one of the first recognitions of aesthetic qualities in the administration of our national forests. He noted there was so little wilderness left where natural conditions are supreme that the superior stands somewhat by itself in this type. The whole place should be kept as near wilderness as possible, the wilderness feature being developed rather than any urban conditions. Moreover, he said, that the area could become in time, and I quote, as priceless as Yellowstone or the Grand Canyon if it remained a water trail wilderness. And thanks to his vision, we have the Boundary Waters Wilderness Area today, the greatest canoe country in the world. As early as 1919, when Carhartt was headquartered in Denver, he received a visit from another Forest Service officer, Alder Leopold. Alder Leopold was born in Iowa, studied forestry at Yale, and then went to work for the U.S. Forest Service in the Southwest, where he became interested in wildlife, primarily in wildlife. And as a consequence of his interest in wildlife, and he saw the development of the Southwest, the shrinkage of habitat for wildlife, he conceived the idea of designating areas with the label wilderness. The existence of a wilderness recreation famine, he wrote, has emerged as an incontrovertible fact. He outlined a concept of wild areas for the Southwest to prevent annihilation of rare plants and animals like the grizzly, to guard against biotic disruption of areas still wild, and to secure recognition as wilderness of low-altitude desert generally regarded as valueless for recreation. Till then, all the only concepts they had of recreation were in mountain lakes, mountains with mountain lakes and forested trees. So he sought to establish an area that became the first designated wilderness in the United States, the Gila Wilderness in New Mexico. That's spelled G-I-L-A, pronounced Gila. In 1924, became the first designated wilderness area in the United States. And that was done through administrative process of the U.S. Forest Service. The chief of the forest proposed that it be a wilderness. His boss approved, and the chief of the Forest Service approved, and said, that's a wilderness. That was the way they did it in those days. Then subsequently, the Forest Service developed new classifications for roadless areas and primitive areas. Part of the reason for them doing this is said to be their bureaucratic rivalry with another federal agency, the National Park Service. The National Park Service had been established in 1916 as a system, although Yellowstone itself, the first national park, was established in 1872. And once the National Park Service was established in 1916, where did it look for new national parks to administer but in the national forests? So The inclination of belief is that the forest, part of the motivation for the Forest Service in turning to wilderness is to say, we can do it just as well, if not better. So in the 1930s, the Forest Service had a system of regulations to establish wilderness areas and wild areas. And the principal person involved was named Robert Marshall. Give me a few names. Carhart, Leopold, Marshall. And Robert Marshall was the chief of recreation in the Forest Service, who came from New York City, of a wealthy family that had property in the Adirondacks, and he had hiked all over the Adirondacks of New York, and then he went to Alaska and lived in Alaska for a while, and wrote some beautiful books about Alaska, lived with people. He worked for a time as chief of recreation in the U.S. Indian Service, Bureau of Indian Affairs, when he went around establishing wilderness areas on Indian reservations, and then they called him back to the Forest Service to be chief of recreation, and he saw national forests fit to provide two distinct recreation environments. One, the comfortable and the modern, and two, as he called it, the peaceful timelessness where vast forests germinate and flourish and die and rot and grow again without any relationship to the ambitions and interferences of man. So this is part of the evolution of thinking of the concept of wilderness protection. He prepared regulations for the Forest Service that were adopted and placed into effect, and which led to the designation of areas as wilderness and wild and primitive, different gradations of protection, let's put it that way. He died in 1939, unfortunately. He was 38 years of age. He was a tremendous hiker who hiked vast distances in a day, died at the age of 38. He was responsible for establishing the Wilderness Society, which still functions today and pursues the protection of wilderness. He died in 1939, and the following year, the Forest Service gave Marshall's name to one of the great wilderness areas not too far from here in northern Montana called the Bob Marshall Wilderness. I don't know if anybody's been here. It's next to Glacier National Park. Now, in 1947, the Forest Service issued a directive to re-emphasize the administrative policies of establishing primitive areas and managing them as though they were wilderness, roadless, protected. But there were powerful influences at work in opposition to wilderness. And some of the most dramatic and most forceful influences against wilderness were in this region right here, in the Pacific Northwest. During World War II, the logging industry appealed for the right to harvest the wilderness in Olympic National Park. The industry said that the Sitka spruce there was fit the exact specifications for military aircraft. Therefore, they had to log in there. Well, they found there was another way of building airplanes without the Sitka spruce, and the Olympics were saved. And at the end of World War II, the American wilderness was still a substantial estate. But in the years immediately following World War II, the whole scene changed. Wherever wilderness was under attack. On the Olympic Peninsula, legislation was introduced each year from 1946 through 1969. Either to reduce the size of the park or to restudy the boundaries in order to transfer to the National Forest, which surrounded the park, the Olympic National Forest around Olympic National Park, transferring to the National Forest the Great Rainforest on the Western Slope. Who's been over there? Just one?
Two.
Over to the Ho and the Bogus Shield and the Queets. These are, you know, the showpieces of the Pacific Northwest.
Gorgeous.
What?
It's gorgeous. And rainy.
and they were, in fact, the legislation was ready to be passed and the National Park Service accepted it. But the industry then said, this was just the first step, and they wanted more. And so they lost everything. Then I must tell you about the big battle in the 1950s in Dinosaur National Monument, where proposals were advanced to build dams at an area called Echo Park, the Dinosaur National Monument, by the Bureau of Reclamation, a big, powerful federal agency. And that was seen as a crisis in conservation. That was an invasion of the national parks that could not be tolerated. It was the first step into more. More invasions in other national parks. So that was a really big battle in the 50s. And it was the first big battle that the post-war battle that the conservationists won. And they saved Dinosaur from the big dams. But in due course, it became perfectly clear that there would be a series of attacks, invasions, intrusions, whatever you want to call it, on wilderness wherever it existed in this country. Methods of logging changed. The loggers wanted the Douglas fir in the Pacific Northwest. And they introduced a method of clear-cutting. And clear-cutting spread throughout the national forest, paralleling the rising demand for timber. And that was going on everywhere in this country. And the Forest Service changed from what they called stewardship or being custodians of the forest to being managers, as they like to say. The forester who had protected wilderness now became a threat. The Forest Service used insect outbreaks as a reason to save the forest from itself, to interrupt the forces of succession that made the forest possible and durable. I'm reading from myself. I wrote this book, Battle for the Wilderness, in 1974, and a new edition came out in 1984, and now I'm preparing a new edition. High-quality virgin timber is now almost always spoken of by the professional forester as old and decadent.
Overmature.
Low-grade second-growth timber is young and productive. Even while these young stands are understocked and producing far below their potential. Foresters say virgin stands are ready to cut, which means they can be logged profitably and therefore should be cut now. If left alone as they have been since the Ice Age, they would be ready to cut in another 100 years too. And then they would be much more valuable. In the meantime, the public could be enjoying all other uses and values of a public forest. So we had our parting of the ways with the Forest Service. And the ultimate showdown that convinced citizen conservationists the Forest Service could not be trusted to preserve wilderness on the basis of administrative regulations, which I mentioned to you before, came here in the North Cascades of the Pacific Northwest. Would you believe it? In 1938, Bob Marshall proposed that 795,000 acres between the North Cascades primitive area and Stevens Pass be studied for a possible wilderness classification. It was one of the finest natural areas in North America, a rough, tall country, interlaced with plant communities, a great refuge for wildlife, including mountain goats, wolverines, grizzly bears, fishes, cougars, and large numbers of bald eagles. In 1940, after the death of Marshall, the forest set aside not 795,000 acres, but only 352,000 acres. And not as a wilderness, but as what they called a limited area. A peculiar classification that seemed to suggest there were too many commercial trees not yet ready to be harvested. And I can remember being out here when I visited the regional forester, I then lived in the East, and he was describing to me the starfish proposal for the North Cascades. What they were going to do was to leave the rock and ice in wilderness and log these valleys. Do you follow me? In the shape of a starfish. So people were very, very unhappy with that. And that led to the great movement for the Wilderness Act of 1964. Now, it's hard to say that so-and-so was the prime mover behind the Wilderness Act or any act. Or one particular episode or incident led to any particular singular action. But I'm trying to reduce it to that for the purpose of discussion here today. All of these things were going on, and many, many people were concerned at all levels, grassroots, Congress, Washington, everywhere, writers, outdoors people, scientists, people who worked for the federal government and wanted things to be as Marshall had planned them. But in 1951, Howard Zahnheiser, and I'll spell his name for you, Zahniser, Howard Zahnheiser spoke first of a national wilderness preservation system. His subject was, how much wilderness can we afford to lose? And I'm asking the same question today. How much wilderness can we afford to lose? I'm giving you the history as a background to where we are now. He saw test cases of civilization everywhere. As he said, of the public interest with reference to wilderness preservation when in conflict with other enterprises. Cases so widespread that citizen conservationists were continually on the defensive without time or energy to pursue a positive program to prevent recurrence of many controversies. Therefore, he called for a bold offensive to enlist public support and congressional action, which ultimately became the Wilderness Act of 1964. Now, it wasn't easy. The first wilderness bill, which he drafted, was introduced in the Senate in 1957 by Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota, with 9 co-sponsors. And in the House of Representatives by Representative John Saylor, S-A-Y-L-O-R, of Pennsylvania. That was 1957. Between June 1957 and May 1964, 18 hearings were held on wilderness proposal in Washington and in the West, all around the country. Zonheiser, or Zonny as he was known, attended every single one of them. I mean, if you wanted a missionary, there he was. I knew him. I didn't know him well, but I knew him well enough. He was studious, soft-spoken, and patient, both persuasive and persistent, a man of love for his fellow men and highly principled. He was somebody nobody could dislike. They could disagree with him, but they couldn't dislike him. And because he had such great principle, they had to listen to him. There was another man like that in Minnesota. Who's from Minnesota, did I ask? Nobody. Well, I'll mention it anyway. There was a man in Minnesota by the name of Heinzelman, Bud Heinzelman, who had worked for the Forest Service as a research scientist and was one of the best research scientists. He spent his whole career working in the Boundary Waters Wilderness. He knew more about the forest in Minnesota than anybody else. And he spent all his free time in the Boundary Waters Wilderness. And when he retired, he made his purpose in life saving the Boundary Waters Wilderness. He died last year, by the by, at the age of 73. And he was another one of those people who never got angry, but kept coming on with data and feeling and experience and knowledge and wisdom and love. So how are you going to turn off a guy like that? And that's the way Zonheiser was. He knew the government, he had worked for the government, and he hung in there with the Wilderness Act. Each year from 1957 through the 18 hearings all around the country, through the opposition of the timber industry, the oil industry, the grazing industry, the mining industry. Nobody ever denied the validity of the wilderness concept. They just said, we don't need so much and we don't need it there, and we have higher values that we need for jobs and economy and prosperity. And the Forest Service didn't like the idea of having a wilderness system and telling them how to administer wilderness lands. And the Park Service didn't like the idea of having a wilderness system. As the Forest Service said, it would hamper free and effective application of administrative judgment, which now determines and should continue to determine the use or combination of uses to which a particular national forest area is put. In other words, leave it to us because we are the experts. But the wilderness cause had powerful champions. Powerful champions in Congress. One of them was Senator Clinton P. Anderson of New Mexico, who was one of the most influential Democrats. He came from New Mexico, and he had been a protege and a friend of Aldo Leopold. And he had worked with Leopold and been with Leopold to the Gila wilderness. So he helped to push the Wilderness Act through the Senate in 1963. By a vote of 73-12, which put the pressure on the House of Representatives, and finally, on July 30th, 1964, only one negative vote was cast. The House version was different than the Senate version because of the powerful chairman of the House Interior Committee, Wayne Aspinall of Colorado, who said, well, I'll let you pass the bill finally, but we have to allow exploration for mining in wilderness until 1983. So that's the way the bill went through. And the president, LBJ, signed the bill on September 3, 1964. Leopold was long gone. Marshall was gone. Zonheiser had given the final years of his life to working in and died in May, just a couple of months before the bill was passed. So I think it's great that we celebrate the 30th anniversary of the Wilderness Bill. And do you know, we now have in the wilderness system 96 million acres of federal land is protected in the wilderness system. Not protected perfectly, but it's protected. Just a second. Administered by four federal agencies, Forest Service, the Park Service, the Fish and Wildlife Service, and the Wildlife Reserve, and the refuges, and the Bureau of Land Management. Since the bill was passed in 1964, more than 100 items of wilderness legislation have been passed by Congress, all of them highly significant supplements to the 1964 Act. Wilderness is always under attack. It always needs defense. But you know, we have 96 million acres, and 10 years from now, we're going to have 125 million acres protected as wilderness. And we're going to have it protected better than it is now. What is your question?
That was my question. Are you planning on progressing with protection of more acres.
Right. Well, we got a lot more acres to go with all the federal agencies. Go ahead.
Should we have a National Park Service and Forest Service administering all these different things, or should it really be one entity?
You know, it's a wonderful question. Because I conceived a program, I don't know whether it's in this book, but I wanted to establish a U.S. Wilderness Service. People who really care about wilderness. Not to administer the land, let it be administered in the national parks and the national forests, but I want experts on wilderness to report on the status of the administration of wilderness. and to tell people these are the uses and the potential for wilderness. This is where it needs to be, where it is, where it ought to be, and how to get it there. This is what communities are doing, and states, some states have their own wilderness systems. This is what the states are doing. This is what we can do locally. This is how people can be involved. We don't know the uses of wilderness in terms of education, therapy, spirituality, whatever you want to call it. So that's my answer to that question. Go ahead.
I guess part of my question is, does it make sense to have national monuments be under whoever, parks be under whoever, recreation areas be under whomever, all of whom have sort of different ways of doing things in terms of educating people, in terms of enlightening people, in terms of training rangers and whatever. And in that sense, it's all kind of a mishmash right now.
I don't know that it's a mishmash, but basically, the people who are in charge all come out of the same schools. They all come out of schools of natural resources, basically forestry schools, that derive from agronomy. That is, they look at the earth as a commodity, not a trust. They look at it in terms of products. They don't read Sand County Almanac by Alder Leopold. They talk about ecology, but they don't understand the principles of ecology.
To some extent, keeping them divided is helpful.
To some extent, keeping them divided absolutely is helpful. That's great, because they've had plans to bring them all into the same agency. I don't see a lot to gain from it, because when politics gets in there, it digs right down through it. But if you have them in different agencies, you have choices. Yes.
I agree with that, but at the same time, if you look at certain areas, at least as ecosystems, as opposed to simply as
right.
Then with the different agencies, you have some real problems. In a sense, at the boundary, different things can happen. In some cases, those boundaries are very artificial to the ecosystems.
Okay, we have up here right now in Bellingham. Bellingham has an organization called the Greater Ecosystem Alliance, which, with the National Parks and Conservation Association, is trying to develop an international park in the North Cascades. And I'm happy to say that the agencies do work together, the North Cascades National Park and the Forest Service and the Snoqualmie Mount Baker National Park. They are working together. But the citizens are the key force, however. And I'm satisfied to proceed on that basis for the time being. But you're absolutely right. I mean, boundaries are meaningless. We're dealing with ecosystems. We have to go beyond the boundaries and that's what Leopold said in Sand County Almanac. He said which Forest Service has difficulty to appreciate. He said, where national forests are around a national park, the national forest should be administered for the same purpose as the park. But you can often see, in many, many cases, you can see where multiple use ends and wilderness or the national park begins where the logging stops. There's where your border is. They log right up to it.
Especially if you go to Mount Rainier, there are points where you can just tell where the logging is.
Sure. Now they're learning and they're changing, or we pray they're changing. And the new chief of the Forest Service is a wildlife scientist, and makes great speeches about the validity of ecosystems, the scientific approach. We won't violate the law, we'll tell the truth, we'll make science-based decisions, but we still don't see enough of it. Yes.
I may have missed this, but I didn't understand what you said about the national, you said, you talked about the national park system being opposed to the wilderness areas, and it sounded like you were opposed to what they would do if they were running the wilderness areas. What's, could you say some more about that?
I can. When the Wilderness Act was proposed in 1957, 1960, until it was passed in 1964, the National Park Service did resist it. They said, we do a better job, or we've got our wilderness protected already. You don't have to worry about it. It's a national park. It's all set. We do it better. We don't want you to tell us how to run our lands, because we're eminently qualified by through experience. But history doesn't show that to be so. That the National Park Service likes to build roads into wilderness. It likes to put facilities into wilderness. I attended the first wilderness hearing dealing with the national park in 1966 in the Great Smoky Mountains of North Carolina, Tennessee. And what did they have for their wilderness proposals? They had one main stem highway across the mountains, bisecting the wilderness in two. They had more roads, more, and big campgrounds, 500-unit campgrounds. So that's why we don't feel that the national parks need the benefit of the Wilderness Act. Does that answer the question?
Yeah, and I haven't been to your lecture, so you may have talked about
this. Okay.
What in what's called the wilderness area now, are there, who does run them, and are there, do you think there should be any provision for people to be able to use them?
There are. People do use them. Now we're actually moving into the new phase of wilderness management, of how many people should be using them. You know that people are allowed to use them. You just got to get in there on your own 2 feet or on a horse. You can't drive in them. No, parks are for people, or wilderness recreation. The trouble is, until now, there's been too much emphasis on recreation and not enough emphasis on ecosystem protection, if you follow me. Now, what wilderness did was, wilderness primarily eliminated roads, logging, mining after 1983, damming of rivers. It allowed grazing under certain circumstances, and there's too much grazing in the wilderness areas. Does that help you? But no, fine, because you're probably asking questions that other people have on their minds.
Well, I've been to Seattle before, but this is my first time hiking in the Northwest, and I left a couple days ago so that I couldn't finally hike.
Right.
And I really appreciated the fact that there was a Park Service bus from Stehekin up to Cottonwood.
Right.
So that I wouldn't have to hike those 20 miles. So that I could, and I assume they control the number of people going in there, because there are only two buses a day, and they only carry their vans that carry about 10 people at most. And so then once we were in there, the campgrounds are small, but they're nice, and the trails are well marked, and they've made real efforts to mark off paths they don't want you to take, and those seem to be coming back. And so it seemed to me, you know, as a person with really limited experience, I was able to have a really nice time for a day and a half doing some great hiking because of the way they prepared what I was coming into.
That's great. That's great. I'm sorry. Carol Reed was going to be here, the Wilderness Ranger. She'll be with us tonight and again tomorrow, hopefully. And she can talk about that to some extent and what she does. And I've worked them and prodded them. And in some cases, they do a wonderful job. It's true, sure. And I know in the North Cascades National Park, they do try hard to do that. But that is so. But many of the areas are overused and abused, and you can tell it.
Oh, yeah, I've been in those places.
Sure, go ahead.
I was just going to mention that I fled from Canada, and last year, Carol Reed was down here talking to us about some of the policies and principles
right.
down here. And one thing they mentioned was that when they go out clearing trails now, they're not even allowed to use a power saw. They have to use a handsaw, and I took that back to some of my people in Canada, and they just laughed. They couldn't believe it. People would be out there just using a handsaw to clear trails. It's just an indication of, you know, I think how enlightened, in some cases, things are around here.
Here's a little publication, Wilderness Watcher, which is published by a group called Wilderness Watch, of which I'm a member. And it was established by a Forest Service retiree to monitor the management of the wilderness in the Forest Service and the other agencies as well. And they brought some suits here and there. Forest Service, they sued them on a lawsuit where the Forest Service encouraged the development of a resort in the wilderness. So we have to watch them until they do a better job.
One of the things I just like to comment on is in terms of ecosystem management, and I know it's hard for a lot of us who come from cities to understand.
Mm-hmm.
If something looks green, we think it's natural.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many of you have been to Ames Way. It's about 18 miles up the trail. This is where this area of the view of Lake Peak. But it's kind of an ecological desert up there. Even though it's green, it was green by sheep up until the 40s. Totally back down. None of the vegetation around there is where it should be. It hasn't come back yet. It's 50 years later. And some of this ecosystem management, we may have to look at people, period, just so we don't permanently destroy it. Because just to say, let a trail come back, it still may not come back because it's so compact or whatever.
I'm glad you brought that up. Yes.
But in some ways, is it any use whatsoever except like hiking in from way out? Abuse? I mean, any use of men, because it tends to be, no matter how we come in, even building a little campsite, is abused because we mistrain the animals. The animals come thinking they'll get scraps. It almost seems like any use is abuse.
You're absolutely right. I mean, any use leaves a mark,
mm-hmm.
an impact. The best of use leaves an impact. They say, leave only footprints, take only photographs. That's fine, but the footprint has an impact. And some places there shouldn't be any footprints at all. Some places should be completely closed. I want to read to you, if I may, a statement by Bill Worf, who was the founder of this group. Wilderness youth, whether recreational or scientific, takes the wilderness as it is. It can't do anything else and be wilderness use. Experiencing, contemplating, studying the uncontrolled ecosystem and facing the challenge and adventure of traveling and living without mechanized aids, with a liberal dose of solitude and with only what you can take with you, is the wilderness experience. There will often be better places than wilderness to catch fish or see elk, where management is directed to maintain these opportunities. There is no intent to make wilderness unappealing, for the use is dependent on wilderness. Letting nature operate freely is really the way to make a wilderness as appealing as possible. So I think it's great, you know, that we talk about this to understand what it is we got there and what it does for us, whether we go into it or not. I just want to mention that two of my books are for sale over at the bookstore, Strangers, and I'm not going to distribute these, but if you want the flyers, you can come up and get them. Strangers in High Places, the story of the Great Smoky Mountains. I spent a lot of time in the Smokies when I lived in the East. And Conscience of a Conservationist. And then I have another book, which is a reissue or new edition of a book I wrote some years ago, Promised Land, Adventures and Encounters in Wild America. And I have two of these books here for you to inspect if you wish. Conscience of a Conservationist and Strangers. And if you buy a book, you get a free autograph. I love the discussion, you know, when you bring up these points that not only questions, but make this important input.
Well, there's a real dilemma that, you know, too much use essentially destroys the wilderness.
Too much use destroys the wilderness.
How do you limit it without trampling on a lot of people's rights and privileges?
Well, in different ways. The worst way is through regulation. So one way is to have more wilderness. Another way is to have wilderness where people live. And the third way is to inform and involve people in decisions regarding wilderness through understanding rather than rules and regulations, which is the best way. And the fourth way is through regulation. And in an increasing number of places, we do have permit systems that work to varying degrees, but to some degrees, in some places, they work very, very well.
And also the movement of Mountaineer some years ago that essentially closed off all but one of the roads.
Mm-hmm.
Requiring people to hike many more miles to get into it, which, you know, basically would have made it much more difficult to get in the summer backcountry there.
Well, I got myself some publicity when I wrote I got another book called Regreening the National Parks, and I said, well, why don't we close off all the roads to Yellowstone for a while, and let people walk in for a change. Because Yellowstone is a tourist slum. And it should be closed. I think it's not the Yellowstone that the people foresaw when they established the park in 1872. But profit and politics is what are calling the shots in those places. Because the rest of the people are not informed and involved. In my view. Yes.
The other thing we need to do, and I think it should go into the schools, to educate people on the hike on trails. They go through switchbacks the long way, or they take shortcuts. They don't have any idea how much of the flora and fauna, you know, that they're ruining. And that we really do have to educate people so that we do.
I see that. I live in Bellingham, Washington, two blocks from a beautiful park, Whatcom Falls Park. And I see that there, that the kids come in. You know, it's an adventure to them. Nobody's told them or explained it to them that you're going to screw this place up. But I think if the teachers understood, and if they walked with their teachers in the second or third grade or whatever grade, they'd get a much better picture of it. I do believe.
You still have to remind them even when you teach them.
Oh, I'm sure.
Dad talking.
I'm sure. Yes, ma'am.
Can you share what is right and what is wrong about the way that logging companies are attempting to publicize their reforestation efforts?
Yeah. Well, that's so easily done because you see these great reproductions of paintings of the beautiful forest, but they're all paintings. They're not the way it is. Their goal is to maximize their profit by doing the cheapest, easiest way and then going on. So the advertising and the publicity is great, but out on the ground it isn't there. It just isn't there anymore.
I think we need to tell them is that if they're doing such a great job of reforesting, good, keep cutting in those reforested areas and leave the virgin country alone.
Well, I think they should do a better... The trouble is, everything affects everything else. I mean, that's what the theme of this, the tapestry, the weaving of tapestry of the world. And if you clear cut over there, you affect me over here. And I think anybody can do anything with their property as long as it doesn't affect somebody else. What they say is, well, we can't afford to do it that way, it's not economical. Well, what these guys need is some social conscience. They'll say, we'll do it if everybody else will, but then they go out and they make sure that they have the exemptions under law. Yes?
Well, okay, you had said that clear cutting was a style of logging that took the place of something else prior.
Right.
What's next? What's after clear cutting that maybe a win-win situation, yeah, that we can nudge them into? Is, yeah, there a way to do it that would mean?
Yes, we can nudge them into it through regulation. For example, next to my house, there's 88 acres that's proposed for logging. They can't log in a wetland, and they can't log along the streams. And so those are protections, and we're fighting for better forest practice laws here in rules and regulations here in the state of Washington. We're getting some of them, so that they are restrained if our Department of Natural Resources goes out and makes and watches them. And what we want to go back is to uneven age logging. Did you want to say something?
One of the other things is that we would subsidize, you know, recycling of paper plants as, to make pulp, as opposed to the way we subsidize cutting the timber. That'd be another issue too. You don't have to cut quite as much if you subsidize that, but we don't want to do that.
I think I spoke on that the other day.
That wasn't at your other session.
What?
That wasn't at your other session.
No, but it's worth reiterating. The volume of paper that we waste, we are so wasteful. One of the most, and what they say to me, I remember the logging people would say to me, well, you write for such and such, you're using paper. When I used to be with Field and Stream, you're using all that paper. And they were right.